It's Friday, May 7th. We got the solution, but does the problem exist? We start here. Florida becomes the latest state to place new restrictions on voting.
It has become just an absolute article of faith in the Republican Party that the last election had major problems.
The next election wars are being waged right now. We'll walk you through what you should know. Two down, hundreds more to go.
Am I actually going to see her today or not?
The Biden White House says it's trying to atone for family separations, but could the number of children in custody keep going up? And a pandemic is fertile ground for concern, but not for babies.
Mom's working, dad's working, everybody's working.
The American birth rate has plummeted to a 40-year low. What impact could that have on those of us who are already here? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Recently, I was watching a TV show that was filmed several years ago, and they were talking about voting. And at one point, somebody says, you know what this country really needs to make it easier to vote? We need to make Election Day a national holiday, which makes a certain kind of sense, right? How many people in this country are not able to make their voice heard because they're working, because their family member got sick that day, because the line is too long? But having just lived through 2020, I was immediately like, wow, that sounds outdated, because we learned what really makes Election Day more accessible to make it Election Week or Election Month.
George, over 11 million votes have already been cast across this country. They are shattering records in places like Texas and Georgia, where people are waiting up to 8 hours in line in some areas.
Last year, in the middle of a pandemic, Americans were given more options to vote early or vote by mail. We saw what happened. Americans did so in record numbers. Voting experts were like, finally, you get it, America. Welcome to the world in which more people vote. But that's not how a lot of states saw it, particularly states where lawmakers supported Donald Trump.
Now, in the intensifying reaction to Georgia's new voting law, the state's governor denouncing Major League Baseball for pulling the All-Star game out of Atlanta.
This does not put Arizonans first. It is a direct attack on voters, and particularly on Latinos and voters of color.
And right now at noon, Governor DeSantis signing a controversial elections bill into law today that he says will prevent fraud.
And yesterday, more than 6 months after Election Day, a day that could have been seen as the beginning of this new era of American voting rights, another Republican governor signed a law making it harder to cast some of these ballots. It's not the only state either. ABC's political director Rick Klein starts us off. Rick, let's start with Florida here. Governor Ron DeSantis signed this bill that is now a law. What does it do?
Yeah, Florida is a state that was championing its last election as the most successful in the state's history.
We're making sure we're enforcing voter ID. Look, you have to show a picture ID to do all these other things in society, clearly voting.
But now, moving forward, it's going to be harder to vote by mail. There'll be additional steps that individuals need to take. There's more danger of being removed from a voter roll if they don't continue to vote and continue to ask for ballots by mail.
Look, I'm not a fan of drop boxes at all, to be honest with you, but the legislature wanted to keep them, but they need to be monitored. You can't just leave these boxes out where there's no supervision.
And generally speaking, it's going to be very disruptive to a state that has been at the forefront of vote by mail and generally to the benefit of Republicans. This is a state that Donald Trump carried by 3 points. Overall, these restrictions mean there will be more security around the ballot box, but it also means that accessibility is going to be severely limited.
But like you said, President Trump won that state anyway, right? So I'm wondering how much practical effect these laws have, because, you know, so you might have to drop off your own ballot instead of having someone drop it off in the drop box for you. You might have to go farther because there's not as many drop off sites for these absentees. Does that affect hundreds of votes, thousands of votes? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, any individual change is easily overcome. But when you think about the changes writ large, and there's now 8 states and counting that have had significant changes to their voting laws that have the impact of restricting the ways that people vote, you're talking about the potential impact on people who have the hardest time voting.
I'm afraid to come out of my house.
Whether those are senior citizens in a state like Florida.
I'm actually supposed to be going somewhere, but my mom won't let me leave until I vote.
Oh, really?
younger voters, voters of color, voters with full-time jobs.
I've seen lots of people leave, you know, that don't have it, understanding employers. Same with me. I've been checking in with my employer like every 30 minutes.
If you voted, say, in Georgia last time, and you knew that there were certain hours that you could vote or certain drop boxes that you could use, that's going to disappear for the next election. So again, people can research it and will need to do a lot of homework to potentially be able to have the same access that they had before. And there's another component that we see in a range of states right now, Brad, which is basically allows more challenges, more poll watchers of a partisan tinge to be there hovering when people are casting their votes, potentially intimidating voters who are maybe a little bit less used to the process.
Right. And within moments of that law being signed, Rick, several groups sued over it, including the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Black Voters Matter, the League of Women Voters of Florida. In the meantime, though, that's it. Like, that's the law. What other states do you have your eye on? Because you said there were other states still in the pipeline here.
Yeah, Texas is next up.
While there is so much competition this year for the worst bill, certainly House Bill 6 and Senate Bill 7 are the ugliest. You can't scrub off the ugly with a steel brush.
The House there just this week has advanced legislation that would do a lot of the same things that that were done in Georgia, some limitations on how localities can make drop boxes and vote by mail opportunities, and also allow for those partisan poll watchers.
To your voice, your vote, and tonight an exclusive update surrounding the state Senate's election audit.
Arizona is another interesting one to watch. There, the Republicans have ordered up a private audit of the count in the most recent presidential election. Even though there have been multiple recounts and legal challenges around it, they're doing their own extra audit.
And anyone who wants to observe already has to jump through hoops. Cyber Ninja's requiring you to submit a resume and at least three references to even be considered. Then, if chosen, commit to being here for 6 hours straight with no access to a phone, a camera, or even a notebook.
And that could be used to inspire some voting changes. So a lot of these legislative sessions are just coming to an end in the next few weeks, but there could be a flurry of late action that's similar to what we've seen.
Hey, what I'm trying to put my finger on, Rick, is whether this is kind of, is this like normal post-election stuff, or is this a huge sea change? Because it's not the first time Republicans, the GOP, has said, listen, we are worried about fraudulent votes, even if there's not evidence of that being a widespread thing in this country, but there are loopholes in the system. Let's fix them. Like, that's not new. It is basically new, though, to be told that to be a top Republican, to be a leader in this party, you have to believe that this last election was completely fraudulent. So where do these laws fit into that spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, you have to realize there's a couple different categories. One is, as you mentioned, a range of states, almost every state, loosened its voting laws to accommodate the pandemic. People were living their lives differently last year.
I've been asked, why is this bill needed? Very simple. The bill is needed because Americans no longer trust the system.
They start from the point of view of, look, lots of people have questions about the last election, and we need to answer those concerns that all of these people have.
That's the premise for all this, is we know that there are lots of questions about the last election. So we start with that, and we're solving that problem for you guys.
Yeah, they start from that point, and what they don't say is the reason that so many people have that belief about the last election are the falsehoods, the lies that continue to be told by President Trump and many of his supporters.
Yes or no? Is it a legitimate election under our Constitution and laws? Yes or no?
Joe Biden is the president. And I think that is a statement of fact, because that's what he is.
And it has become a mantra in the Republican Party, even among some folks who defended the last election. Liz Cheney's big sin in the eyes of the Republican Conference of the House is that she's telling the truth about the facts of the last election.
Trump himself endorsed New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik to replace Cheney in the Republican leadership.
It should be noted that even Liz Cheney supports a lot of these laws.
Cheney actually voted for the Trump agenda nearly 93% of the time. Much more than Stefanik.
But it has become just an absolute article of faith in the Republican Party that the last election had major problems and was actually stolen, when that's just flatly not the case.
Governor Ron DeSantis, sir, thank you very much for joining us live with
a very
boisterous crowd. Happy to be up and on TV with you. Thank you, sir.
A lot of great folks down here in Palm Beach County. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. All
right. Right, and perhaps as jarring as anything in the law, yes, but that sound you're hearing is from Fox News, because this announcement in Florida yesterday was actually only open to reporters from Fox News. Governor DeSantis gave a news outlet an exclusive, not on a big interview with him, but on the actual governing of a state. It was Fox and Trump-supporting Republicans. That is who was invited to this thing that could affect a lot of Floridians. Critics saying that just shows you how sort of closed off this loop of logic is, that there is a particular audience for all this. Rick Klein, our political director, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, they couldn't hug their mother for years, and they're still some of the lucky ones. We're back after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
They barely let me know this week, and it was just like just literally 3-4 days ago, and I was just like, I can't believe it. You know, am I actually gonna see her today or not?
Earlier this week, the Biden White House said, okay, remember all those kids that were separated from their families after they crossed the border illegally under President Trump? And then even though a judge said that was illegal, a lot of them just got lost in the system. This week, we are starting to reunite those families.
Sure, like seeing her in person, being able to give her a hug and everything, it was just...
Does it feel like a dream?
Yes, it actually
does. End of a nightmare?
Yes.
We've now seen some of these reunifications on tape, and to watch these family members see each other's faces for the first time in years is... You can't not be compelled by this. But this handful of videos is also some of the only footage of these reunifications because, frankly, there aren't a ton happening. ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman is on the border. He's in Donna, Texas with a reality check. Matt, what does this all look like from where you stand?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. We're not seeing many of those images because there have only been two so far, right? There are an estimated 1,000 families that remain separated. The Biden administration says it is working to identify them. Once it does, it hopes to be able to make a decision on whether or not they want to be reunited, whether or not that's feasible. But, you know, when you see those images, Brad, it not only gives you a sense of the joy that these families are experiencing right now, but the depths of the misery that they must have felt over the years that they've been separated. And it shows the cruelty of the family separation ruling, which, as you noted, a judge ruled unlawful.
Right. And like when you see the raw emotion here, I'm thinking of these sons who are just crying like little boys, because when you think about a few years ago, like that's what they were. They were boys. It makes you realize how many lives have just been irreversibly changed from this, and how you just multiply that across hundreds and hundreds of families who have still not been brought back together yet. But those are crossings from a few years ago. What is happening now in a place like Donna, Texas? There was a surge at the beginning of the Biden presidency. Is that continuing in the same way?
The short answer is no, the volume has certainly decreased, but there's still a lot of it. You know, I was at this Donna Border Patrol facility, which has basically been the poster child for massive overcrowding.
1,556% capacity.
Yep.
Right now with mostly unaccompanied minors. There are kids that are sleeping on floors. They are packed into these pods.
It's the first port of call, essentially, for migrants crossing the border. It's where they're processed. If they're children, they then get sent to long-term shelters where, at some point, caseworkers will try to reunite them with family members or sponsors in the U.S.
Is what's happening inside acceptable to you? And when is this going to be fixed?
That's a serious question, right? Is it acceptable to me? Come on. That's why we're going to be moving 1,000 of those kids out quickly.
So the rules are, obviously, it's going to be pen and pad, right?
No cell phone, no electronics, no nothing. If y'all could just leave them in the vehicle or you don't.
And we were just there, and it still looked extraordinarily busy, even though there were essentially 10 times fewer people being processed than at its peak, essentially on April 2nd. We saw women still nursing babies coming in, their pants muddy from crossing the Rio Grande, the tongues of their sneakers hanging out because the laces had been taken out. We saw lots of kids, some of them very young.
Do not come. The journey is dangerous. We are building safe, orderly, and humane ways to address the needs of vulnerable children.
One of the things that's most important to note is that the Border Patrol officials tell us they're very proud of the fact that they've been able to reduce the amount of time, especially that unaccompanied minors spend at these facilities, from about 5 or 6 days on average to 24 hours. But they're telling us they expect large numbers of people to continue to come throughout the summer. And, you know, we're just at the start of what is considered the peak of migration season. So it's not really going to let up anytime soon. There may have been a lull that we're in right now, but still, they expect many more people to come.
Yeah, being presented as this kind of new era, this new 4 years in terms of border policy, but things there not as simple, and they don't change as quickly as a new White House might like. Matt Gutman back in Donna, Texas at the border. Thanks so much.
You got it, Brad.
And if we're talking about love for your family, remember, Mother's Day is this Sunday. If you had forgotten and you were going to get in trouble, you're welcome. But just this week, the CDC actually put out new numbers about families in America.
Birth and fertility rates in the U.S. dropped to record lows last year.
The rate dropped for moms of every major race and ethnicity and in nearly every age group.
Those numbers show that in 2020 alone, the birth rate in this country went down 4%. That's a big drop, and it comes on the heels of other big drops, meaning we now have the lowest birth rate that we've had in this country for 40 years. That has implications for everyone here, regardless of how big your family is, and it can particularly matter for women and mothers. I want to turn to Pamela Perlick from the University of Utah. She's the demographics director for the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute, specializes in demographic shifts. And Pamela, can I just ask first, why did we drop off this last year so much? Because early on in the pandemic, everyone was making jokes about like, oh, we're all going to be trapped together. Watch out for the coronavirus boom.
Oh, yes. There was a lot of that kind of talk early on. But, you know, this isn't like that there was just a blackout or something where people were losing electricity for, the weekend or whatever. This is a very terrifying event, a global pandemic. And by the way, millions of people lost their jobs. So the uncertainty about the whole situation, the risk to health and well-being. Already young folks who are thinking about having children are kind of concerned about whether they'll have the economic stability, whether they'll have the ability to support more children. It makes perfect sense that people would delay having children till a time when they had a little better picture of what the future might bring.
Welcome back, everyone. A few years ago, the majority of U.S. adults surveyed said families of three or more were ideal. But now Americans say two children, well, that's best.
There's a long-term trend of people having smaller and smaller families that goes back for a century anyway. And that has a lot to do with the move from rural economy to urban economy. Mm. And so at one time, children were actually workers. Children were actually viewed as assets in the family production.
They didn't have to read or write. They didn't have to be educated and all of that. And they could grow up and be productive with minimal education. Then comes the industrial economy. Kids have to learn to read. We pass laws. They've got to go to school.
But as we move to cities, then children become very expensive. They become liabilities and they become investments.
Employers find that women can do many jobs as well as men. Some jobs better.
So ladies, drop the kitchen mop.
And so you began to see the more demands that were placed on women and men, as a matter of fact, the fewer children people began to have.
You're expecting a baby this year. Well, you'll need a lot of diapers and, of course, a lot of cash. Costs about $250,000 to raise a child from birth through age 17.
Now, in this most recent time, you'll remember the recession that we had with the financial crisis in 2008. That's when births, the numbers of babies born in the nation and in Utah, peaked. And now for every year after that, the actual number of babies born in the U.S. and, oh, by the way, in Utah, the birth capital of the country, have gone down.
Wait, so up until 2008 then, they're slowing. They're not actually going down.
then you're saying 2008 hits and boom, the number of births in a given year has not gone up since.
Right, right.
But what is the issue with that? Because I thought a lower birth rate is usually a sign of prosperity, right? It's usually a sign of more equality or education in a country. What's the issue?
It's an immediate pressing issue because if you think about how many years it's been that births have been going down since 2008, that's a shrinking labor force. And they, you know, those folks are, right. I mean, do the math on how old those folks are. And if the number of people being born keeps going down, then it has implications for how big each generation is. It's smaller and smaller and smaller.
All my friends are psyched for senior year, but I'm graduating early and moving in with Ryan because I'm pregnant.
Fertility has fallen, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years, because of that we've almost eliminated teenage births or births to teenage mothers. That has been a concerted effort to try to get young women to understand the high cost to themselves and their futures of having children when they are themselves very young. That's a good thing. But the real bottom line is, if you have an aging society and people are not having children, then you end up with a population distribution with lots and lots of old folks, not very many young, productive people.
Not many taxpayers.
Not many taxpayers and a declining population. Now, that's if the trends play out. It's not a done deal that they will. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many people speculating now that there'll be a little bit of a birth resurgence as the pandemic lifts, because people who didn't have children during the pandemic say, yay, life, we can go back to normal. We'll have our kids now. But this longer term trend, if it persists, we end up like Japan. Hmm.
Japan has one of the world's oldest populations, coupled with one of the world's lowest birth rates.
Their population is becoming very elderly. There aren't as many youth. The number of deaths outnumber the number of births, and they have actual population decline. I mean, we do have an example of what happens if these trends play out.
Well, so then what do we do? Because, like, if, like, I don't want to call it a death spiral, but if you're saying, like, there's this cycle where your population is aging and you can't quite replace it unless you get a lot of, like, other people from other countries, and that's not happening, like, what would you do to stop that? Like, how would you get back to an equilibrium somehow?
Let's, for a minute, just think about, what if we made a pronatal policy? What mm-hmm. would that look like? Well, what are the barriers to people having children during these modern times?
Millennials are being hit hard by a financial downturn for a second time.
I think we were on uncertain footing to begin with. We recovered, and now I think we're kind of getting a new kick in the teeth.
The cost of living is extremely high and rising, and, you know, the cost of housing is becoming unapproachable for people. The cost of affordable quality daycare, that keeps going up.
The choice of work and kids, it shouldn't be a choice. Like, I shouldn't have to, I want to be the best mom I can be.
Just the cost of raising children continues to go up. And oh, by the way, people are working 2 and 3 jobs. Mom's working, dad's working, everybody's working.
I feel like we're doing so much. I kind of liken it to you're trying to plug holes in a sinking boat.
This pandemic has particularly disadvantaged women because of the industries they work in that have been impacted by the virus and the shutdowns, by also for the fact that they are still the primary child care people, actually caregivers in general. Although there have been some progress, women do bear this burden.
Most economists are calling this the she session. This is likely to set women back a generation, even if you will, in terms of what this means for women's progress in the workforce.
So unless we come up with some way to support young families, this trend will continue. Women will continue to bear the burden of these kinds of changes. One of the things that I've been speculating about is in thinking about the last time we had a pandemic, following that pandemic, we had the Roaring Twenties, and we had a very robust women's suffrage movement, a feminist movement. And I'm wondering how much of that feminist movement was a backlash by women against the disproportionate burdens and suffering that they bore during that pandemic, and wondering if coming out of this one, that women will become more energized to become more powerful in the political sphere and make the kind of changes necessary to support young families so that the people who want to have kids can have them. That's the whole point.
All right, that is Pamela Perlick from University of Utah. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for inviting me, and happy Mother's Day.
Okay, let's take another quick break, because when we come back, one last thing to the moon.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. The next 48 hours is about to get really weird for the financial world, all because of a cute little doge.
It's not doggy coin. It's not dodgy coin. It's Dogecoin.
This week, the story of Wall Street has been a cryptocurrency called Dogecoin. It's like Bitcoin, except Bitcoin was created to be a serious alternative to paper money. Dogecoin was created to be a really funny version of it. It's literally based on a meme of a silly-looking Shiba Inu dog.
I bought it originally as a joke, and to me, it's still somewhat of a joke.
But a few weeks ago, the price of Dogecoin suddenly started to rise. And then this week, it took off like a dog in a rocket ship.
In just 1 year, Dogecoin's value up a mind-boggling 23,000%.
Currently, right now, it's about worth $650,000.
$1.25 million. That is $1.25 million up from $180,000.
Why? Well, you remember GameStop?
We're calling it the Reddit trade, for lack of a better term. But
did you see that spike? Yes. The shorts believe the company's worthless, but the longs think it's going to the moon.
That was really a lot of people's introduction to this idea that something did not need to be a great stock to make you a lot of money. If enough people thought it was fun enough, they could make the price rise.
What is it? The SEC? What kind of case do they have? We like the stock.
Now, usually, if you think that stock is overvalued, you're in luck, because you can short sell it. But GameStop also taught traders that if that price keeps going up, even if it's a temporary rise, your little short sale trick can cost you more than you've got. You can go out of business trying to outsmart the mob. Now, GameStop is at least a company with employees. Dogecoin, and I cannot stress this enough, is a made-up currency based on a meme with captions like, much happy. So everyone's waiting to see if the price stays like this as the trading week ends. But that's not where this roller coaster ends.
We got to talk about Doge. More importantly, the Doge father.
18 hours ago, Elon Musk tweeted, the Doge father, SNL, May 8th. Now Doge is sitting at 31.47 cents.
See, tomorrow night, Elon Musk is set to host SNL. And while he's known for building cars and rocket ships, he's also become an outspoken cheerleader for virtual currencies, including Dogecoin.
What would be the most ironic outcome? That the currency that was invented as a joke, in fact, becomes the real currency.
And if we live in a world where these surges are based completely on rah-rah groupthink, would Elon Musk ever consider using a live TV show to hype up his portfolio? That is what the virtual currency world has its eyes on. Short sellers are terrified to make huge bets against it anymore, and you now live in a world where a joke investment has become much, much serious. For all the talk about Elon Musk and Dogecoin to the moon, the other reason to keep your head up this weekend, a Chinese rocket is scheduled to fall back to Earth. We think it's Saturday, but no one's quite sure where it's going to land. So, I don't know. Good luck. Start Here is produced by David Ryan, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Ariel Chester, Lewis Millman, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia DeShishku. Special thanks this week to Guy Davies, Kate Shaw, Chris Berry, and my man Devin Dwyer. Thanks for filling in, Devin. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.